picking up speed until they rattled like hail. Overholzer looked around angrily, now so red he was nearly purple. "I'd speak," he shouted. "Would he not hear me, I beg?"
Cries of "No, no," and "Not now," and "Jaffords has the feather," and "Sit and listen," came in response. Tian had an idea Cy Overholzer was learning, and remarkably late in the game, that there was often a deep-running resentment of a village's richest and most successful. Those less fortunate or less canny, most of the time they amounted to the same, might tug their hats off when the rich folk passed in their buckas or low coaches. They might send a slaughtered pig or cow as a thank you when the rich folk loaned their hired hands to help with a house or barn raising. The well-to-do might be cheered at year-end gathering for helping to buy the piano that now sat in the pavilion's musica. Yet the men of the Kala tromped their shore boots to drown Overholzer out with a certain savage satisfaction.
Overholzer, unused to being balked in such a way, flabbergasted, in fact, tried one more time. "I'd have the feather, do you, I beg?"
"No,"
Tian said. "Later if it does you, but not now." There were actual cheers at this, mostly from the smallest of the smallhold farmers and some of their hands. The Mani did not join in. They were now drawn so tightly together that they looked like a dark blue ink stain in the middle of the hall. They were clearly bewildered by this turn. Von Eisenhart and Diego Adams, meanwhile, moved to flank Overholzer and speak low to him. "You've got a chance," Tian thought. "Better make the most of it." He raised the feather, and they quieted.
"Everyone will have a chance to speak," he said. "As for me, I say this. We can't go on this way, simply bowing our heads and standing quiet when the wolves come and take our children. They always return them," a hand named Farron Porcella said timidly. "They return husks," Tian cried, and there were a few cries of "hear him." Not enough, however, Tian judged, not enough by far, not yet. He lowered his voice again. He did not want to harangue them. Overholzer had tried that and gotten nowhere, 1,000 acres or not.
"They return husks. And what of us? What is this doing to us? Some might say nothing, that the wolves have always been a part of our life in Calabrin Sturgis, like the occasional cyclone or earthshake. Yet that is not true. They've been coming for 6 generations at most, but the Kala's been here 1,000 years and more."
The old Manny with the bony shoulders and baleful eyes half rose.
"He says true, Fulkin. There were farmers here, and Manny folk among them, when the darkness in Thunderclap hadn't yet come, let alone the wolves."
They received this with looks of wonder. Their awe seemed to satisfy the old man, who nodded and sat back down.
"So in time's greater course, the wolves are almost a new thing," Tian said. 6 times have they come, over mayhap 120 or 140 years, who can say, for as you can, time has softened somehow."
A low rumble, a few nods.
"In any case, once a generation," Tian went on.
He was aware that a hostile contingent was coalescing around Overholzer, Eisenhart, and Adams. Ben Sleitman might or might not be with them, probably was. These men he would not move even if he were gifted with the tongue of an angel. Well, he could do without them, maybe, if he caught the rest.
"Once a generation they come, and how many children do they take? 3 dozen? 4? Cy Overholzer may not have babbies this time, but I do. Not 1 set of twins, but 2. Hedden and Hedda, Lyman and Leah. I love all 4, but in a month of days, 2 of them will be taken away, and when those 2 come back, they'll be ruined. Whatever spark there is that makes a complete human being, it'll be out forever."
"Hear him, hear him," swept through the room like a sigh.
"How many of you have twins with no hair except that which grows on their heads?" Tian demanded. "Raise your hands."
6 men raised their hands. Then 8. 12. Every time Tian began to think they were done, another reluctant hand went up. In the end, he counted 22 hands, and of course, not everyone who had children was here. He could see that Overholzer was dismayed by such a large count. Diego Adams had his hand raised, and Tian was pleased to see he'd moved away a little bit from Overholzer, Eisenhart, and Sleitman.
Three of the Mani had their hands up. Borja Estrada.
Louis Haycox. Many others he knew, which was not surprising, really. He knew almost every one of these men. Probably all, save for a few wandering fellows working small-hold farms for short wages and hot dinners. "Each time they come and take our children, they take a little more of our hearts and our souls," Tien said.
"Oh, come on now, son," Eisenhart said. "That's laying it on a bit "Shut up, rancher," a voice said.
It belonged to the man who had come late, he with a scar on his forehead. It was shocking in its anger and contempt.
"He's got the feather. Let him speak out to the end."
Eisenhart whirled around to Mark, who had spoken to him so. He saw and made no reply. Nor was Tien surprised.
"Thank you, Pear," Tien said evenly. "I've almost come to the end. I keep thinking of trees. You can strip the leaves of a strong tree and it'll live. Cut its bark with many names, and it will grow its skin over them again. You can even take from the heartwood and it'll live. But if you take of the heartwood again and again and again, there will come a time when even the strongest tree must die. I've seen it happen on my farm, and it's an ugly thing. They die from the inside out. You can see it in the leaves as they turn yellow from the trunk to the tips of the branches. And that's what the wolves are doing to this little village of ours.
What they're doing to our Kala."
"Hear him," cried Freddy Rosario from the next farm over. "Hear him very well."
Freddy had twins of his own, although they were still on the tit and so probably safe.
Tien went on. "You say that if we stand and fight, they'll kill us all and burn the Kala from east border to west."
"Yes," Overholzer said. "So I do say, nor am I the only one." From all around him came rumbles of agreement.
"Yet each time we simply stand by with our heads lowered and our hands open while the wolves take what's dearer to us than any crop or house or barn, they scoop a little more of the heart's wood from the tree that is this village."
Tien spoke strongly, now standing still with the feather raised high in one hand.
"If we don't stand and fight soon, we'll be dead anyway. This is what I say, Tien Jeffords, son of Luke. If we don't stand and fight soon, we'll be ruined ourselves."
Loud cries of "Hear him!" Exuberant stomping of shore boots, even some applause. George Telford, another rancher, whispered briefly to Eisenhart and Overholzer. They listened, then nodded. Telford rose. He was silver-haired, tanned, and handsome in the weather-beaten way women seemed to like.
"Had your say, son?" he asked kindly, as one might ask a child if he had played enough for one afternoon and was ready for his nap.
"Yeah, I reckon," Tien said. He suddenly felt dispirited. Telford wasn't a rancher on a scale with Vaughn Eisenhart, but he had a silver tongue.
Tien had an idea. He was going to lose this after all.
"May I have the feather, then?"
Tien thought of holding on to it, but what good would it do? He'd said his best. Had tried. Perhaps he and Zelia should pack up the kids and go out west themselves, back toward the Mids. Moon to moon before the wolves came, according to Andy. A person could get a hell of a head start on trouble in 30 days. He passed the feather. "We all appreciate young Cy Jaffords's passion, and certainly no one doubts his courage," George Telford said. He spoke with the feather held against the left side of his chest, over his heart. His eyes roved the audience, seeming to make eye contact, friendly eye contact, with each man. "But we have to think of the kiddies who'd be left, as well as those who'd be taken, don't we? In fact, we have to protect all the kiddies, whether they be twins, triplets, or singletons like Cy Jaffords is Aaron."
Telford turned to Tien now. "What will you tell your children, as the wolves shoot their mother and mayhap set their grandpere on fire with one of their light sticks? What can you say to make the sound of those shrieks all right? To sweeten the smell of burning skin and burning crops that its souls we're a-saving? Or the heart's wood of some make-believe tree?"
He paused, giving Tien a chance to reply, but Tien had no reply to make. He'd almost had them. but he'd left Telford out of his reckoning, smooth-voiced son-of-a-bitch Telford, who was also far past the age when he needed to be concerned about the wolves calling into his dooryard on their great grey horses. Telford nodded, as if Tian's silence was no more than he expected, and turned back to the benches. "When the wolves come," he said, "they'll come with fire-hurling weapons. The light sticks, you can, and guns, and flying metal things. I misremember the name of those. The buzz balls," someone called.
"The sneeches," called someone else.
"Stealthies," called a third. Telford was nodding and smiling gently. A teacher with good pupils. "Whatever they are, they fly through the air, seeking their targets. And when they lock on, they put forth whirling blades as sharp as razors. They can strip a man from top to toe in 5 seconds, leaving nothing around him but a circle of blood and hair. Do not doubt me, for I have seen it happen." Hear him well," the men on the benches shouted. Their eyes had grown huge and frightened. "The wolves themselves are terrible fearsome," Telford went on, moving smoothly from one campfire story to the next. "They look somewhat like men, and yet they are not men, but something bigger and far more awful. And those they serve in Far Thunderclap are more terrible by far. Vampires, I've heard. Men with the heads of birds and animals, mayhap. Broken Helm, undead Ronin, warriors of the Scarlet Eye." The men muttered. Even Tian felt a cold scamper of rat's paws up his back at the mention of the eye. "The wolves I've seen, the rest I've been told," Telford went on. "And while I don't believe it all, I believe much. But never mind Thunderclap and what may den there. Let's stick to the wolves. The wolves are our problem, and problem enough. Especially when they come armed to the teeth." He shook his head, smiling grimly. "What would we do? Perhaps we could knock them from their great horses with hoes, Cy Jeffords, do you think?" Derisive laughter greeted this. "We have no weapons that can stand against them," Telford said. He was now dry and businesslike, a man stating the bottom line. "Even if we had such, we're farmers and ranchers and stockmen, not fighters. We—"
"Stop that yellow talk, Telford. You ought to be ashamed of yourself."
Shocked gasps greeted this chilly pronouncement. There were cracking backs and creaking necks as men turned to see who had spoken. Slowly then, as if to give them exactly what they wanted, the white-haired latecomer in the long black coat and turned-around collar rose slowly from the bench at the very back of the room. The scar on his forehead, it was in the shape of a cross, was bright in the light of the kerosene lamps. It was the old fella. Telford recovered himself with relative speed, but when he spoke, Tian thought he still looked shocked. "Beg pardon, Per Callahan, but I have the feather."
"To hell with your heathen feather, and to hell with your cowardly counsel," Per Callahan said.
He walked down the center aisle, stepping with the grim gait of arthritis. He wasn't as old as the Manny Elder, nor nearly so old as Tian's grandpere, who claimed to be the oldest person not only here but in Calla Lockwood to the south. And yet he seemed somehow older than both. Older than the ages. Some of this, no doubt, had to do with the haunted eyes that looked out at the world from below the scar on his forehead. Zelia claimed it had been self-inflicted. More had to do with the sound of him. Although he had been here enough years to build his strange man-Jesus church and convert half the Kala to his way of spiritual thinking, not even a stranger would have been fooled into believing Per Callahan was from here. His alienness was in his flat and nasal speech and in the often obscure slang he used, street jive, he called it. He had undoubtedly come from one of those other worlds the Manny were always babbling about, although he never spoke of it, and Calla Bryn Sturgis was now his home. He had the sort of dry and unquestionable authority that made it difficult to dispute his right to speak, with or without the feather. Younger than Tian's grandpère he might be, but Père Callahan was still the old fellow. Four. Now he surveyed the men of Calabrin Sturgis, not even glancing at George Telford. The feathers sagged in Telford's hand. He sat down on the first bench, still holding it.
Callahan began with one of his slang terms, but they were farmers, and no one needed to ask for an explanation.
This is chicken shit.
He surveyed them longer. Most would not return his look. After a moment, even Eisenhart and Adams dropped their eyes. Overholzer kept his head up, but under the old fellow's hard gaze, the rancher looked petulant rather than defiant.
Chicken shit,
the man in the black coat and turned around collar repeated, enunciating each syllable. A small gold cross gleamed below the notch in the backwards collar. On his forehead, that other cross, the one Zelia believed he'd carved in his flesh with his own thumbnail in partial penance for some awful sin, glared under the lamps like a tattoo.
This young man isn't one of my flock, but he's right, and I think you all know it. You know it in your hearts. Even you, Mr. Overholzer, and you, George Telford.
No such thing, Telford said, but his voice was weak and stripped of its former persuasive charm.
All your lies will cross your eyes. That's what my mother would have told you.
Callahan offered Telford a thin smile Tian wouldn't have wanted pointed in his direction. And then Callahan did turn to him.
I never heard it put better than you put it tonight, boy. Thank you, Si.
Tian raised a feeble hand and managed an even more feeble smile. He felt like a character in a silly festival play saved at the last moment by some improbable supernatural intervention.
I know a bit about cowardice, may it do ya, Callahan said, turning to the men on the benches. He raised his right hand, misshapen and twisted by some old burn, looked at it fixedly, then dropped it to his side again.
I have personal experience, you might say. I know how one cowardly decision leads to another, and another, and another, until it's too late to turn around, too late to change. Mr. Telford, I assure you the tree of which young Mr. Jafford spoke is not make-believe. The Kala is in dire danger. Your souls are in danger.
Hail Mary, full of grace, said someone on the left side of the room. The Lord is with thee. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb,
Bag it, Callahan snapped. Save it for Sunday.
His eyes, blue sparks in their deep hollows, studied them.
For this night, never mind God and Mary and the man Jesus. Never mind the light sticks and the buzz-bugs of the wolves, either. You must fight. You're the men of the color, are you not? Then act like men. Stop behaving like dogs crawling on their bellies to lick the boots of a cruel master.
Overholzer went dark red at that and began to stand. Diego Adams grabbed his arm and spoke in his ear. For a moment, Overholzer remained as he was, frozen in a kind of crouch, and then he sat back down. Adams stood up.
Sounds good, Padrone,
Adams said in his heavy accent.
Sounds brave. Yet there are still a few questions, mayhap. Haycox asked one of him. How can ranchers and farmers stand against armed killers?
By hiring armed killers of our own, Callahan replied.
There was a moment of utter, amazed silence. It was almost as if the old fellow had lapsed into another language. At last, Diego Adams said cautiously,
I don't understand.
Of course you don't, the old fellow said. So listen and gain wisdom. Rancher Adams and all of you, listen and gain wisdom. Not 6 days' ride nor west of us, and bound southeast along the path of the beam, come three gunslingers and one prentice.
He smiled at their amazement. Then he turned to Sleitman.
The prentice isn't much older than your boy, Ben, but he's already as quick as a snake and as deadly as a scorpion.
The others are quicker and deadlier by far. I have it from Andy, who's seen them. You want hard calibers? They're at hand. I set my watch and warrant on it.
This time, Overhauser made it all the way to his feet. His face burned as if with a fever. His great pod of a belly trembled.
What children's goodnight story is this? He asked. If there ever were such men, they passed out of existence with Gilead. And Gilead has been dust in the wind for 1,000 years.
There were no mutterings of support or dispute, no mutterings of any kind. The crowd was still frozen, caught in the reverberation of that one mythic word. Gunslingers.
You're wrong, Callahan said. But we don't need to fight over it. We can go and see for ourselves. A small party will do, I think. Jaffet's here, myself. And what about you, Overhauser? Want to come?
There ain't no gunslingers, Overhauser roared.
Behind him, Borges Estrada stood up.
Per Callahan, God's grace on you, and you, Borges. But even if there were gunslingers, how could 3 stand against 40 or 60? And not 40 or 60 normal men, but 40 or 60 wolves. Hear him, he speaks sense.
Eben Took, the storekeeper, called out.
And why would they fight for us? Estrada continued. We make it from year to year, but not much more. What could we offer them beyond a few hot meals? And what man agrees to die for his dinner?
Hear him! Hear him!
Telford, Overhauser, and Eisenhart cried in unison. Others stamped rhythmically up and down on the boards. The old fellow waited until the stomping had quit, and then said,
I have books in the rectory. 6 dozen.
Although most of them knew this, the thought of books, all that paper, still provoked a general sigh of wonder.
According to one of them, gunslingers were forbidden to take reward, supposedly because they descend from the line of Arthur Eld.
The Eld, the Eld, the Manny whispered, and several raised fists into the air with the first and fourth fingers pointed. Hook'em horns, the old fellow thought. Go Texas. He managed to stifle a laugh, but not the smile that rose on his lips.
Are you speaking of hard cases who wander the land, doing good deeds? Telford asked in a gently mocking voice. Surely you're too old for such tales, Pear?
Not hard cases, Callahan said patiently. Gunslingers. How can 3 men stand against the wolves, Pear?
Tian heard himself ask. According to Andy, one of the gunslingers was actually a woman. But Callahan saw no need to muddy the waters further, although an impish part of him wanted to just the same.
That's a question for their din, Tian. We'll ask him. And they wouldn't just be fighting for their suppers, you know, not at all.
What else, then? Bucky Javier asked.
Callahan thought they would want the thing that lay beneath the floorboards of his church. And that was good, because that thing had awakened. The old fella, who had once run from a town called Jerusalem's Lot in another world, wanted to be rid of it. If he wasn't rid of it soon, it would kill him. Ka had come to Calabrin Sturgis. Ka, like a wind.
In time, Mr. Javier, Callahan said. All in good time, Si.
Meantime, a whisper had begun in the gathering hall. It slipped along the benches from mouth to mouth, a breeze of hope and fear. Gunslingers. Gunslingers to the west come out of Midworld. And it was true, God help them. Arthur Eld's last deadly children moving toward Calabrin Sturgis along the path of the beam. Ka, like a wind.
Time to be men, Per Callahan told them.
Beneath the scar on his forehead, his eyes burned like lamps. Yet his tone was not without compassion.
Time to stand up, gentlemen. Time to stand and be true.
Part 1. Todash. Chapter 1. The Face on the Water. 1. Time is a face on the water. This was a proverb from the long ago in far-off Magis. Eddie Dean had never been there. Except he had, in a way. Roland had carried all 4 of his companions, Eddie, Susanna, Jake, Oi, to Magus one night, storying long as they camped on I-70, the Kansas Turnpike, in a Kansas that never was. That night he had told them the story of Susan Delgado, his first love, perhaps his only love, and how he had lost her. The saying might have been true when Roland had been a boy not much older than Jake Chambers, but Eddie thought it was even truer now, as the world wound down like the mainspring in an ancient watch. Roland had told them that even such basic things as the points of the compass could no longer be trusted in Midworld. What was dead west today might be southwest tomorrow, crazy as that might seem. And time had likewise begun to soften. There were days Eddie could have sworn were 40 hours long, some of them followed by nights, like the one on which Roland had taken them to Magus, that seemed even longer. Then there would come an afternoon when it seemed you could almost see darkness bloom as night rushed over the horizon to meet you. Eddie wondered if time had gotten lost. They had ridden and riddled out of a city called Ludd on Blaine the Mono. "Blaine is a pain," Jake had said on several occasions, but he, or it, turned out to be quite a bit more than just a pain. Blaine the Mono had been utterly mad. Eddie killed it with illogic. "Something you're just naturally good at, sugar," Susanna told him. And they had detrained in a Topeka which wasn't quite part of the world from which Eddie, Susanna, and Jake had come. Which was good, really, because this world, one in which the Kansas City pro baseball team was called the Monarchs, Coca-Cola was called Nozola, and the big Japanese car maker was Takuro rather than Honda, had been overwhelmed by some sort of plague which had killed damn near everyone. So stick that in your Takuro spirit and drive it, Eddie thought. The passage of time had seemed clear enough to him through all of this. During much of it he'd been scared shitless. He guessed all of them had been, except maybe for Roland. But yes, it had seemed real and clear. He'd not had that feeling of time slipping out of his grasp, even when they'd been walking up I-70 with bullets in their ears, looking at the frozen traffic and listening to the warble of what Roland called a finny. But after their confrontation in the Glass Palace, with Jake's old friend, the TikTok man, and Roland's old friend, Flag or Martin or just perhaps Marilyn, time had changed.
"Not right away, though. We traveled in that damned pink ball, saw Roland kill his mother by mistake, and when we came back..."
Yes, that was when it had happened. They had awakened in a clearing perhaps 30 miles from the Green Palace. They had still been able to see it, but all of them had understood that it was in another world. Someone or some force had carried them over or through the thinny and back to the path of the beam. Whoever or whatever it had been, it had actually been considerate enough to pack them each a lunch, complete with Nozola sodas and rather more familiar packages of Keebler cookies. Near them, stuck on the branch of a tree, had been a note from the being Roland had just missed killing in the palace. "Renounce the tower. This is your last warning." Ridiculous, really. Roland would no more renounce the tower than he'd kill Jake's pet Billy Bumbler and then roast him on a spit for dinner. None of them would renounce Roland's dark tower. God help them, they were in it all the way to the end. "We got some daylight left," Eddie had said on the day they'd found Flagg's warning note. "You want to use it or what?" "Yes," Roland of Gilead had replied. "Let's use it." And so they had. Following the path of the beam through endless open fields that were divided from each other by belts of straggly, annoying underbrush. There'd been no sign of people. Skies had remained low and cloudy day after day and night after night. Because they followed the path of the beam, the clouds directly above them sometimes roiled and broke open, revealing patches of blue, but never for long. One night they opened long enough to disclose a full moon, with a face clearly visible on it. The nasty, complicitous squint and grin of the peddler. That made it late summer by Roland's reckoning, but to Eddie it looked like half past no time at all. The grass mostly listless or outright dead. The trees, what few there were, bare. The bushes scrubby and brown. There was little game, and for the first time in weeks, since leaving the forest ruled by Shardik, the cyborg bear, they sometimes went to bed with their bellies not quite full. Yet none of that, Eddie thought, was quite as annoying as the sense of having lost hold of time itself. No hours, no days, no weeks, no seasons, for God's sake. The moon might have told Roland it was the end of summer, but the world around them looked like the first week of November, dozing sleepily toward winter. Time, Eddie had decided during this period, was in large part created by external events. When a lot of interesting shit was happening, time seemed to go by fast. If you got stuck with nothing but the usual boring shit, it slowed down. And when everything stopped happening, time apparently quit altogether. Just packed up and went to Coney Island. Weird, but true. Had everything stopped happening? Eddie considered, and with nothing to do but push Susanna's wheelchair through one boring field after another, there was plenty of time for consideration. The only peculiarity he could think of since returning from the wizard's glass was what Jake called the mystery number, and that probably meant nothing. They'd needed to solve a mathematical riddle in the Cradle of Lud in order to gain access to Blaine, and Susanna had suggested the mystery number was a holdover from that. Eddie was far from sure she was right, but hey, it was a theory. And really, what could be so special about the number 19? Mystery number, indeed. After some thought, Susanna had pointed out it was prime, at least, like the numbers that had opened the gate between them and Blaine the Mono. Eddie had added that it was the only one that came between 18 and 20 every time you counted. Jake had laughed at that and told him to stop being a jerk. Eddie, who had been sitting close to the campfire and carving a rabbit, when it was done it would join the cat and dog already in his pack, told Jake to quit making fun of his only real talent. 2. They might have been back on the path of the beam 5 or 6 weeks when they came to a pair of ancient double ruts that had surely once been a road. They didn't follow the path of the beam exactly, but Roland swung them onto it anyway. It bore closely enough to the beam for their purposes, he said. Eddie thought being on a road again might refocus things, help them to shake that maddening, becalmed-in-the-horse latitudes feeling, but it didn't. The road carried them up and across a rising series of fields like steps. They finally topped a long north-south ridge. On the far side, their road descended into a dark wood. Almost a fairy tale wood, Eddie thought, as they passed into its shadows. Susanna shot a small deer on their second day in the forest. Or maybe it was the third day, or the fourth. And the meat was delicious after a steady diet of vegetarian gunslinger burritos, but there were no orcs or trolls in the deep glades, and no elves, Keebler or otherwise. No more deer, either. "I keep looking for the candy house," Eddie said. They'd been winding their way through the great old trees for several days by then, or maybe it had been as long as a week. All he knew for sure was that they were still reasonably close to the path of the beam. They could see it in the sky, and they could feel it. "What candy house is this?" Roland asked. "Is it another tale? If so, I'd hear." Of course he would. The man was a glutton for stories, especially those that led off with a once upon a time when everyone lived in the forest. But the way he listened was a little odd, a little off. Eddie had mentioned this to Susanna once, and she'd nailed it with a single stroke, as she often did. Susanna had a poet's almost uncanny ability to put feelings into words, freezing them in place. "That's 'cause he doesn't listen all big-eyed like a kid at bedtime," she said. "That's just how you want him to listen, Honeybunch." "And how does he listen?" "Like an anthropologist," she had replied promptly, "like an anthropologist trying to figure out some strange culture by their myths and legends." She was right, and if Roland's way of listening made Eddie uncomfortable, it was probably because in his heart Eddie felt that if anyone should be listening like scientists, it should be him and Suze and Jake. because they came from a far more sophisticated where and when, didn't they?
Whether they did or didn't, the four had discovered a great number of stories that were common to both worlds. Roland knew a tale called Diana's Dream that was eerily close to The Lady or the Tiger, which all three exiled New Yorkers had read in school. The tale of Lord Perth was similar to the Bible story of David and Goliath. Roland had heard many tales of the man Jesus, who died on the cross to redeem the sins of the world, and told Eddie, Susanna, and Jake that Jesus had his fair share of followers in Midworld. There were also songs common to both worlds. Careless Love was one, Hey Jude was another, although in Roland's world, the first line of this song was, "Hey Jude, I see you, lad." Eddie passed at least an hour telling Roland the story of Hansel and Gretel, turning the wicked child-eating witch into Rhea of the Coos almost without thinking of it. When he got to the part about her trying to fatten the children up, he broke off and asked Roland, "Do you know this one? A version of this one?" "No," Roland said, "but it's a fair tale. Tell it to the end, please." Eddie did, finishing with the required, "They lived happily ever after," and the gunslinger nodded, "No one ever does live happily ever after. But we leave the children to find that out for themselves, don't we?" "Yeah," Jake said. Oi was trotting at the boy's heel, looking up at Jake with the usual expression of calm adoration in his gold-ringed eyes.
"Yeah,"
the bumbler said, copying the boy's rather glum inflection exactly. Eddie threw an arm around Jake's shoulders.
"Too bad you're over here instead of back in New York," he said. "If you were back in the Apple, Jakey boy, you'd probably have your own child psychiatrist by now. You'd be working on these issues about your parents, getting to the heart of your unresolved conflicts. Maybe getting some good drugs, too, Ritalin, stuff like that."
"On the whole, I'd rather be here," Jake said, and looked down at Oi.
"Yeah," Eddie said, "I don't blame you."
"Such stories are called fairy tales," Roland mused.
"Yeah," Eddie replied.
"There were no fairies in this one, though."
"No," Eddie agreed. "That's more like a category name than anything else. In our world, you got your mystery and suspense stories, your science fiction stories, your westerns, your fairy tales. Get it?"
"Yes," Roland said. "Do people in your world always want only one story flavor at a time? Only one taste in their mouths?"
"I guess that's close enough," Susanna said.
"Does no one eat stew?" Roland asked.
"Sometimes at supper, I guess," Eddie said. "But when it comes to entertainment, we do tend to stick with one flavor at a time and don't let any one thing touch another thing on your plate. Although it sounds kind of boring when you put it that way."
"How many of these fairy tales would you say there are?" With no hesitation, and certainly no collusion, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake all said the same word at exactly the same time.
19.
And a moment later, Oi repeated it in his hoarse voice.
19.
They looked at each other and laughed, because 19 had become a kind of jokey catchword among them, replacing bum hug, which Jake and Eddie had pretty much worn out. Yet the laughter had a tinge of uneasiness about it, because this business about 19 had gotten a trifle weird. Eddie had found himself carving it on the side of his most recent wooden animal, like a brand. "Hey there, pard, welcome to our spread. We call it the Bar 19. Both Susanna and Jake had confessed to bringing wood for the evening fire in armloads of 19 pieces. Neither of them could say why. It just felt right to do it that way, somehow. Then there was the morning Roland had stopped them at the edge of the wood through which they were now traveling. He had pointed at the sky, where one particularly ancient tree had reared its hoary branches. The shape those branches made against the sky was the number 19. Clearly 19. They had all seen it, but Roland had seen it first. Yet Roland, who believed in omens and portents as routinely as Eddie had once believed in light bulbs and AA batteries, had a tendency to dismiss his quartet's odd and sudden infatuation with the number. They had grown close, he said, as close as any quartet could, and so their thoughts, habits, and little obsessions had a tendency to spread among them all like a cold. He believed that Jake was facilitating this to a certain degree.
You've got the touch, Jake, he said. I'm not sure that it's as strong in you as it was in my old friend, Alain. But by the gods, I believe it may be.
I don't know what you're talking about, Jake had replied, frowning in puzzlement.
Eddie did, sort of, and guessed that Jake would know in time. If time ever began passing, in a normal way again, that was. And on the day Jake brought the muffin balls, it did. 3. They had stopped for lunch. More uninteresting vegetarian burritos. The deer meat now gone and the Keebler cookies little more than a sweet memory. When Eddie noticed that Jake was gone and asked the gunslinger if he knew where the kid had gotten off to. Peeled off about half a wheel back, Roland said, and pointed along the road with the two remaining fingers of his right hand. He's all right. If he wasn't, we'd all feel it. Roland looked at his burrito, then took an unenthusiastic bite.
Eddie opened his mouth to say something else, but Susanna got there first. Here he is now. Hi there, sugar. What you got?
Jake's arms were full of round things the size of tennis balls. Only these balls would never bounce, true. They had little horns sticking up from them. When the kid got closer, Eddie could smell them, and the smell was wonderful, like fresh baked bread.
I think these might be good to eat, Jake said. They smell like the fresh sourdough bread my mother and Mrs. Shaw, the housekeeper, got at Zabar's.
He looked at Susanna and Eddie, smiling a little.
Do you guys know Zabar's?
I sure do,
Susanna said. Best of everything, and they do smell fine. You didn't eat any yet, did you?
No way,
he looked questioningly at Roland. The gunslinger ended the suspense by taking one, plucking off the horns, and biting into what was left. Muffin balls, he said. I haven't seen any in God's know how long. They're wonderful. His blue eyes were gleaming. Don't want to eat the horns. They're not poison, but they're sour. We can fry them if there's a little deer fat left. That way they taste almost like meat.
Sounds like a good idea, Eddie said. Knock yourself out. As for me, I think I'll skip the mushroom muff divers or whatever they are.
They're not mushrooms at all, Roland said. More like a kind of ground berry.
Susanna took one, nibbled, then helped herself to a bigger bite.
You don't want to skip these, sweetheart, she said. My daddy's friend, Pop Mose, would have said, these are prime.
She took another of the muffin balls from Jake and ran a thumb over its silky surface.
Maybe, he said. But there was this book I read for a report back in high school. I think it was called We Have Always Lived in the Castle, where this nutty chick poisoned her whole family with things like that.
He bent toward Jake, raising his eyebrows and stretching the corners of his mouth in what he hoped was a creepy smile.
Poisoned her whole family, and they died in agony.
Eddie fell off the log on which he had been sitting and began to roll around on the needles and fallen leaves, making horrible faces and choking sounds. Oi ran around him, yipping Eddie's name in a series of high-pitched barks.
Quit it, Roland said. Where did you find these, Jake?
Back there, he said. In a clearing I spotted from the path. It's full of these things. Also, if you guys are hungry for meat, I know I am, there's all kinds of sign. A lot of the scat's fresh.
His eyes searched Roland's face.
Very fresh scat.
He spoke slowly, as if to someone who wasn't fluent in the language. A little smile played at the corners of Roland's mouth.
Speak quiet, but speak plain, he said.
What worries you, Jake?
When Jake replied, his lips barely made the shapes of the words.
Men watching me while I pick the muffin balls.
He paused, then added,
They're watching us now.
Susanna took one of the muffin balls, admired it, then dipped her face as if to smell it like a flower.
Back the way we came? To the right of the road?
Yes, Jake said. Eddie raised a curled fist to his mouth as if to stifle a cough and said,
How many?
I think four.
Five, Roland said. Possibly as many as six. One's a woman. Another a boy not much older than Jake.
Jake looked at him, startled. Eddie said,
How long have they been there?
Since yesterday, Roland said. Cut in behind us from almost dead east.
And you didn't tell us?
Susanna asked. She spoke rather sternly, not bothering to cover her mouth and obscure the shapes of the words. Roland looked at her with the barest twinkle in his eye. I was curious as to which of you would smell them out first. Actually, I had my money on you, Susanna. She gave him a cool look and said nothing. Eddie thought there was more than a little Detta Walker in that look and was glad not to be on the receiving end.
What do we do about them? Jake asked.
For now, nothing, the gunslinger said. Jake clearly didn't like this.
What if they're like TikTok's Quartet, Gasher and Hoots and those guys?
They're not.
How do you know?
Because they would have set on us already and they'd be fly food. There seemed no good reply to that, and they took to the road again. It wound through deep shadows, finding its way among trees that were centuries old. Before they had been walking 20 minutes, Eddie heard the sound of their pursuers, or shadowers, snapping twigs, rustling underbrush, once even a low voice. Slew feet, in Roland's terminology. Eddie was disgusted with himself for remaining unaware of them for so long. He also wondered what Jan Cullies did for a living. If it was tracking and trapping, they weren't very good at it. Eddie Dean had become a part of Midworld in many ways, some so subtle he wasn't consciously aware of them, but he still thought of distances in miles instead of wheels. He guessed they'd come about 15 from the spot where Jake rejoined them with his muffin balls and his news when Roland called it a day. They stopped in the middle of the road, as they always did since entering the forest. That way the embers of their campfire stood little chance of setting the woods on fire. Eddie and Susanna gathered a nice selection of fallen branches, while Roland and Jake made a little camp and set about cutting up Jake's trove of muffin balls. Susanna rolled her wheelchair effortlessly over the duff under the ancient trees, piling her selections in her lap. Eddie walked nearby, humming under his breath.
"Look it over to your left, sugar," Susanna said.
He did, and saw a distant orange blink. A fire.
"Not very good, are they?" he asked.
"No. Truth is, I feel a little sorry for him."
"Any idea what they're up to?"
But I think Roland's right. They'll tell us when they're ready. Either that or decide we're not what they want and just sort of fade away. Come on, let's go back."
"Just a second." He picked up one more branch, hesitated, then took yet another. Then it was right.
"Okay,"
he said.
As they headed back, he counted the sticks he'd picked up, then the ones in Susanna's lap. The total came to 19 in each case.
"Suze," he said, and when she glanced over at him, time started up again.
She didn't ask him what he meant, only nodded.
4. Eddie's resolution about not eating the muffin balls didn't last long. They just smelled too damn good sizzling in the lump of deer fat Roland, thrifty, murderous soul that he was, had saved away in his scuffed old purse. Eddie took his share on one of the ancient plates they'd found in Shardik's woods and gobbled them. "These are as good as lobster," he said, then remembered the monsters on the beach that had eaten Roland's fingers. "As good as Nathan's hot dog is what I meant to say, and I'm sorry for teasing you, Jake."
"Don't worry about it," Jake said, smiling. "You never tease hard."
"One thing you should be aware of," Roland said. He was smiling. He smiled more these days, quite a lot more, but his eyes were serious. "All of you. Muffin balls sometimes bring very lively dreams."
"You mean they make you stoned?" Jake asked, rather uneasily. He was thinking of his father, Elmer Chambers, had enjoyed many of the weirder things in life.
"Stoned? I'm not sure.
Buzzed, high, seeing things. Like when you took the mescaline and went into the stone circle where that thing almost, you know, almost hurt me."
Roland paused for a moment, remembering. There had been a kind of succubus imprisoned in that ring of stones. Left to its own devices, she undoubtedly would have initiated Jake Chambers sexually, then fucked him to death. As matters turned out, Roland had made it speak. To punish him, it had sent him a vision of Susan Delgado.
"Roland?"
Jake was looking at him anxiously. "Don't concern yourself, Jake. There are mushrooms that do what you're thinking of, change consciousness, heighten it, but not muffin balls. These are berries, just good to eat.
If your dreams are particularly vivid, just remind yourself you are dreaming. Eddie thought this a very odd little speech. For one thing, it wasn't like Roland to be so tenderly solicitous of their mental health. Not like him to waste words, either. Things have started again, and he knows it, too, Eddie thought. There was a little time out there, but now the clock's running again. Game on, as they say.
We going to set a watch, Roland? Eddie asked.
Not by my warrant, the gunslinger said comfortably, and began rolling himself a smoke.
You really don't think they're dangerous, do you?
Susanna said, and raised her eyes to the woods, where the individual trees were now losing themselves in the general gloom of evening. The little spark of campfire they'd noticed earlier was now gone, but the people following them were still there. Susanna felt them when she looked down at Oi and saw him gazing in the same direction. She wasn't surprised. I think that may be their problem, Roland said.
What's that supposed to mean?
Eddie asked, but Roland would say no more. He simply lay in the road with a rolled-up piece of deerskin beneath his neck, looking up at the dark sky and smoking. Later, Roland's quartet slept. They posted no watch and were undisturbed. 5. The dreams, when they came, were not dreams at all. They all knew this except perhaps for Susanna, who in a very real sense was not there at all that night.
My God, I'm back in New York, Eddie thought. And on the heels of this, really back in New York, this is really happening.
It was. He was in New York, on Second Avenue. That was when Jake and Oi came around the corner from 54th Street.
Hey, Eddie, Jake said, grinning. Welcome home.
Game on, Eddie thought. Game on. Chapter 2. New York Groove. 1. Jake fell asleep looking into pure darkness. No stars in that cloudy night sky, no moon. As he drifted off, he had a sensation of falling that he recognized with dismay. In his previous life, as a so-called normal child, he'd often had dreams of falling, especially around exam time. But these had ceased since his violent rebirth into Midworld. Then, the falling feeling was gone. He heard a brief, chiming melody that was somehow too beautiful. 3 notes, and you wanted it to stop. 12, and you thought it would kill you if it didn't. Each chime seemed to make his bones vibrate. Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it, he thought, for although the chiming melody was nothing like the sinister warble of the thinny, somehow it was. It was. Then, just when he truly believed he could bear it no longer, the terrible, gorgeous tune stopped. The darkness behind his closed eyes suddenly lit up a brilliant dark red. He opened them cautiously on strong sunlight and gaped at New York. Taxis bustled past, gleaming bright yellow in the sunshine. A young black man wearing Walkman earphones strolled by Jake, bopping his sandaled feet a little bit to the music and going cha-da-bow, cha-da-bow under his breath. A jackhammer battered Jake's eardrums. Chunks of cement dropped into a dump truck with a crash that echoed from one cliff face of buildings to another. The world was adin with racket. He had gotten used to the deep silences of Midworld without even realizing it. No more had come to love them. Still, this noise and bustle had its attractions, and Jake couldn't deny it. Back in the New York groove, he felt a little grin stretch his lips.
Ache, ache, cried a low, rather distressed voice.
Jake looked down and saw Oi sitting on the sidewalk with his tail curled neatly around him. The Billy Bumbler wasn't wearing little red booties, and Jake wasn't wearing the red Oxfords, thank God. But this was still very like their visit to Roland's Gilead, which they had reached by traveling in the pink wizard's glass. The glass ball that had caused so much trouble and woe. No glass this time, he'd just gone asleep. But this was no dream. It was more intense than any dream he'd ever had, and more textured. Also,
people kept detouring around him and Oi as they stood to the left of a midtown saloon called Kansas City Blues. While Jake was making this observation, a woman actually stepped over Oi, hitching up her straight black skirt a bit at the knee in order to do so. Her preoccupied face, "I'm just one more New Yorker minding my business, so don't screw with me," was what that face said to Jake, never changed. "They don't see us, but somehow they sense us. And if they can sense us, we must really be here." The first logical question was, why? Jake considered this for a moment, then decided to table it. He had an idea the answer would come. Meantime, why not enjoy New York while he had it? "Come on, Oi," he said, and walked around the corner. The Billy Bumbler, clearly no city boy, walked so close to him that Jake could feel his breath feathering against his ankle. "Second Avenue," he thought. Then, "My God." Before he could finish the thought, he saw Eddie Dean standing outside of the Barcelona luggage store, looking dazed and more than a little out of place in old jeans, a deerskin shirt, and deerskin moccasins. His hair was clean, but it hung to his shoulders in a way that suggested no professional had seen to it in quite some time. Jake realized he himself didn't look much better. He was also wearing a deerskin shirt, and on his lower half, the battered remains of the Dockers he'd had on the day he left home for good, setting sail for Brooklyn, Dutch Hill, and another world. "Good thing no one can see us," Jake thought, then decided that wasn't true. If people could see them, they'd probably get rich on spare change before noon. The thought made him grin. "Hey, Eddie," he said, "welcome home." Eddie nodded, looking bemused. "See, you brought your friend." Jake reached down and gave Oi an affectionate pat. "He's my version of the American Express card. I don't go home without him." Jake was about to go on. He felt witty, bubbly, full of amusing things to say, when someone came around the corner, passed them without looking, as everyone else had, and changed everything. It was a kid wearing Dockers that looked like Jake's because they were Jake's. Not the pair he had on now, but they were his, all right. So were the sneakers. They were the ones Jake had lost in Dutch Hill. The plaster man who guarded the door between the worlds had torn them right off his feet. The boy who had just passed them was John Chambers. It was him, only this version looked soft and innocent and painfully young. "How did you survive?" he asked his own retreating back. "How did you survive the mental stress of losing your mind and running away from home in that horrible house in Brooklyn? Most of all, how did you survive the doorkeeper? You must be tougher than you look." Eddie did a double take, so comical that Jake laughed in spite of his own shocked surprise. It made him think of those comic book panels where Archie or Jughead is trying to look in two directions at the same time. He looked down and saw a similar expression on Oi's face. Somehow that made the whole thing even funnier. "What the fuck?" Eddie asked.
"Instant replay," Jake said, and laughed harder. It came out sounding goofy as shit, but he didn't care. He felt goofy. "It's like when we watched Roland in the Great Hall of Gilead, only this is New York and it's May 31st, 1977. It's the day I took French leave from Piper. Instant replay, baby."
"French?" Eddie began, but Jake didn't give him a chance to finish. He was struck by another realization, except struck was too mild a word. He was buried by it. Like a man who just happens to be on the beach when a tidal wave rolls in. His face blazed so brightly that Eddie actually took a step back.
"The rose," he whispered.
He felt too weak in the diaphragm to speak any louder, and his throat was as dry as a sandstorm.
"Eddie, the rose."
"What about it?"
"This is the day I see it."
He reached out and touched Eddie's forearm with a trembling hand.
"I go to the bookstore, then to the vacant lot. I think there used to be a delicatessen."
Eddie was nodding and beginning to look excited himself.
"Tom and Jerry's Artistic Deli, corner of 2nd and 46th.
The deli's gone, but the rose is there. That me walking down the street is going to see it, and we can see it too." At that, Eddie's own eyes blazed.
"Come on, then," he said. "We don't want to lose you, him, whoever the fuck."
"Don't worry," Jake said.
I know where he's going.
2. The Jake ahead of them, New York Jake, spring of 1977 Jake, walked slowly, looking everywhere, clearly digging the day. Mid-world, Jake remembered exactly how that boy had felt, the sudden relief when the arguing voices in his mind